From the studios of KUSP Radio in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Dave Kerr is my guest. He's been writing about film for the last 40 years or so. His column in the New York Times is a history of the cinema disguised as a DVD new releases feature. Dave Kerr is also the author of When Movies Mattered, Reviews from a Transformative Decade, an anthology of film pieces from the Chicago Reader, where he was the film critic between 1974 and 1986. Dave Kerr, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for having me.
You talk in When Movies Mattered about an era that's now past, when free weekly newspapers abounded and there was room for lengthy essays on the cinema. But your book really covers a period when watching movies fundamentally changed forever with the advent of home video, which has now exponentially bloomed.
One has mixed feelings about so many things. Home video has brought a degree of convenience to seeing older films that we never had before, clearly. At the same time, it's really seriously reduced the number of films that one can see. And I'm afraid that trend is only increasing with the coming of Blu-ray and now with streaming video. The number of older movies, you know, pre-1990, just shrinking all the time.
People don't like to see black and white. They're just like opposed to black and white because they're stupid.
Well, what can I say? I really don't understand where that attitude comes from. I think people think that they're being deprived of something when they see a film in black and white. When in fact, there is a great deal there. There's an entire aesthetic that belongs to black and white that is in danger of being lost. And certainly that kind of work can have a visual impact that color cannot.
Yeah. I also think it's bad for silent films. I mean, the way people watch movies now, I don't think lends itself to watching silent films, because you can't look away from a silent film.
Very true, very true. And it's hard to watch a silent film by yourself at home, because those films were designed to be seen with audiences of 2,000-3,000 people. To see Keaton's The General sitting alone in front of your television, you smile from time to time. You may laugh out loud a few times. But to see that film in an auditorium that's just full of people, it's a totally different experience. And he designed those films, timed the laughs for a huge group. And all that is just kind of lost, kind of wasted when you're watching it by yourself.
Oh, I mean, maybe that's true with every theatrical movie made before 1981.
Very likely, yeah. I think the era of the movie palaces, where people would go and spend an evening at the movies without even really knowing what they were going to see or much caring, you would have these very complicated evening-long programs. The feature film was only one part of it. You had a bunch of shorts, a newsreel, cartoons, often a preliminary organ concert, maybe even a couple of acts of vaudeville. It was a communal experience where you would see your friends and neighbors. And the theater was the center of the community in a way that theaters now really aren't. Just another storefront, really.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, now they're all divided up with you know, 8 movies or 16 movies. So even if people go to the movies together, they might not go to the same movie.
Yeah, and then when you get into the movie, you find so many people who are immediately just diving for their cell phones and spend the entire movie texting, so they're not even fully present at that point. People just, I think, are living in their own little bubbles. You know, we're so used to the convenience of cell phones and, now pad computing, we just sit with those little screens in front of our face, and that shared experience is something that's rapidly fading away.
Well, you know, you mentioned how the advent of Blu-ray and streaming has kind of cut back on the vintage movies that we love so much being released by major studios, but you seem to find things to discuss every week from these obscure places, like Twilight Time and Grapevine and all the things that you've got me spending my money on.
Yeah, it's no longer the major studios who are releasing the more interesting stuff, even from their own libraries. They tend now to license it to smaller distributors. Many of them do, you know, wonderfully good work with it. It's just it doesn't seem to be worth it economically to the studios to distribute films that will sell, you know, 5,000-10,000 copies. It's just small change to them, so they're no longer interested.
What are some of the passions that you've developed lately that you've discovered? You tell us every week in your New York Times column, but what do you?
Oh, there's just so much out there. I just wrote about a French director named Pierre Etakes, who was active in the '60s and the '70s, and whose films kind of disappeared for 20 years when they got tied up in some legal problems. And those just got cleared up maybe 2 years ago. They came out again in France, and they've come out here again through Criterion. Speaking of Keaton, he has a very strong relationship to Keaton, the same kind of, it's almost cold, removed, ironic stance, very, very meticulous construction of the sight gags. None of the sentimentality one associates with clowns or Al Chaplin in particular. Really kind of acerbic and kind of bitter and quite interesting.
Yes, as always, you piqued my interest when you wrote about him last week. We're talking with Dave Kerr, and his latest book, which you should all read, is wonderful. It's called When Movies Mattered, Reviews from a Transformative Decade. Do you think older movies are just better than newer movies? Do you go to the movies a lot? Do you see a lot of new films?
Not so much anymore. I was a first-string critic for 30 years, which meant seeing 8 or 9 new American movies a week. And that was something I enjoyed doing at the time. And now that it's no longer my job, I feel kind of alienated from that. These days I see maybe 1 or 2 new movies a month, mainly a question of not having time to see a great deal else.
Because you're watching Wheeler and Woolsey comedies.
Well, for example, yeah, it's often necessary to see 12 or 15 films in the course of a week in order to, you know, sort through enough of the stuff to find a decent column.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So that takes up the hours.
Well, that's some great stuff. I was particularly excited by your column a few weeks ago about Wheeler and Woolsey, and I watched a couple of them. I especially enjoyed Hips, Hips, Hooray.
Oh, yeah. Well, great title, huh?
Yeah.
That's.
It's amazing how a comedy team that made so many movies could be so completely forgotten.
It is. It's almost inexplicable. They were very big stars in the early 30s, and I think things changed up on them when the production code came into force. It really curtailed the kind of a ribald comedy that they were doing. And of course, Bob Woolsey was very ill and died young of a liver ailment, which obviously cut short the career of the team. And they just didn't seem to survive the 40s. People did not know who they were. By the time the war was over, Burke Wheeler actually ended up making a couple of short films for the Columbia Shorts Department, which was kind of the end of the line for a lot of the silent comedians. The Keaton ended up there, Charlie Chase. Not a happy place. You know, just kind of rehashing the old stuff on very tiny budgets.
Yeah. Unless they were the Three Stooges, which had their entire career over there.
Yes. I'm not a big Stooge fan. I know millions are. I don't want to
No, that's okay. You know, in fact,
irritate anybody with that, but it's,
I want to ask you about that. You often don't like things that everyone treasures. like, for instance, I've heard you, or read you, make some comments about Gone with the Wind. Now, you've never actually said Gone with the Wind is a bad movie, but you said in your article about George Cukor, I think it was, You said that it's too bad that Cukor had been fired from Gone with the Wind, because if he directed it, it might have been a great film instead of just a big one.
Yeah. Well, I think a part of being a critic is having independent opinions. Sometimes people don't like having their children called ugly, and I understand the emotional attachment that people have to films, and I would never want to, you know, tell someone that they're wrong to like a movie.
Yeah.
But part of what I enjoy by reading other critics is discovering a different point of view, you know, another angle on something familiar, passing along received wisdom is not so interesting, and of course perversity for its own sake is not particularly interesting either, but when you have a different understanding of something, that's kind of when I perk up.
So what would you, as a critic, what's wrong with Gone with the Wind? I mean, it's got a beautiful score, it's got great acting, it's got special effects, it's well written. What's wrong with it?
Well, I find the direction really kind of flat and inconsistent. Cukor was one of the great masters of blocking. He'd been a very successful Broadway director before he came to Hollywood, so he understood the mechanics and the expressive quality of moving people around in a space. And you can really see that playing out in the early scenes of Gone with the Wind, which he directed, the early Tara scenes.
Mm-hmm. Did he direct the scene where we first see Rhett Butler from the top of the stairs looking up at the girls?
I believe so, yeah. And you see, in sequences like that, the way he's using a point of view, the way he's arranging people in relation to each other, it's not only visually interesting, but it's also dramatically expressive in ways that Victor Fleming, who was the main person who finished the movie, a lot of people had a hand in that film, just never had that quality. He's pretty much of a straight-on, close-up, two-shot guy. Doesn't really get into, you know, the expressive qualities of the medium all that much.
In your article that you wrote about the Godfather trilogy, you talked a little bit about the last film of the trilogy, and you talked about the change in the acting style of Al Pacino, that he wasn't quite the actor that he had been earlier. And so what I wonder about is film acting in general, and how much of it has to do with the director and the script. I mean, if The Godfather Part III had a better script, wouldn't it be a lot better movie?
Very likely, but as it turns out, Coppola apparently took Godfather 1 and charted out all the emotional peaks and valleys and then tried to replicate them in Godfather 3 because he thought that's the way the film worked. And clearly, it didn't work like that. The film just doesn't feel very organic to me. It feels a little forced and unnecessary, which it obviously was.
Yeah.
Pacino, by that point, I think you don't direct him anymore. He's got his own ideas about things. He spent a little too much time, I think, with Sidney Lumet, who was a director who really encouraged that kind of hyperventilating acting that I associate with Pacino these days.
Mm-hmm. The kind of latter-day Joan Crawford style.
Yeah. He's just always always heading for a climax. Every line has to be a, you know, big sacco delivery, and that's just, it's not good acting, you know. You build to those moments. You don't play everything out on the same high pitch. A good actor knows that, and a good director, you know, should be very sensitive to when that's happening. But very often in Hollywood, it's directors don't have, particularly these days, the kind of power to overrule a major star like that. So they just have to take what they can get.
We were talking about Wheeler and Woolsey a little while ago, and their films have been re-released by the Warner Archive, which is this marvelous company that's put things out just for Dave Kerr and myself, and maybe four other people that went
on. Apparently.
They also put out a lot of vintage television shows. Do you ever watch those old TV shows?
Not so much, really. Again, it's a question mainly of time. There's only so many hours in the day. I've usually got a couple of movies to get through every day, so I don't watch much television in general. I don't even have cable TV, actually. But, you know, again, nothing against it. Obviously, it's a very rich field. At the moment, it may be a richer field than theatrical films for particular kind of storytelling.
I think television today is better than the movies, and I think it's better than the movies for the same reason that we like some of the older films more than some of the newer films, in that there's a certain economy in television because you have to be done in 52 minutes. And I think one of the things that I don't like about modern movies is, you know, they're really long.
Well, you often get the sense that you're watching a 70-minute B-movie from 1940 that's been blown up to 2 hours and 40 minutes with this ridiculously inflated budget and way too many digital effects. And the core of the thing is really not that much more complex than a chapter from a Republic serial.
They could have done it in 12 minutes.
Pretty much, you know. And the serials certainly have the benefit of not being pretentious and not overstaying their welcome. They get in and get out. They give you, you know, a few good fist fights and car going over a cliff, and everybody's happy. And there's kind of that, I think, the really outsized ambition of the Batman films, which, you know.
Yes.
The guy seems to think he's, I don't know, doing a German myth or something. It's just, it's too much for that material to bear.
There's also a
sense. There's not enough there to handle the bombast of the style. Sorry?
I agree. I think they're very portentous, but without any payoff.
Yeah, it's just, we're going to go dark. We're going to go dark. You know, that's the new thing. I guess we're going to be seeing a dark Lone Ranger this summer. And in fact, the original material is actually fairly dark. He's the survivor of a massacre who's going to, you know, avenge his fellow Ranger buddies. And I wonder
how much darker
new motivations are being added on to this one, but yeah, I mean, that was not exactly happy material.
The Outlaw Josie Wales going. Version of the Lone Ranger.
I guess so. Yeah.
Well, you know, I was watching some Bud Butterker the other day because I read your column about that, and I like how Bud Butterker can tell a story. And Chris, he made several westerns with Randolph Scott, and those movies, the credits play, and the movie has started. Bing. In an hour and 18 minutes, it's going to be over, so they don't waste any time.
Absolutely. Sure. I mean, Bud was somebody I knew very well, and I worked on a film about him some years ago. I spent a lot of time with him. He was just a wonderful raconteur and someone who never set out to be an artist, never set out to be a filmmaker. He was a rich kid from Indiana who ran away from home and decided to become a bullfighter. He went to Mexico and learned bullfighting. Ended up in Hollywood as a technical consultant on the Tyrone Power version of Blood and Sand. And from that, talked his way into a directing job. Like a lot of those older guys, you know, they had lives before they became filmmakers. It wasn't straight from film school to Sundance to Disney to obscurity, which is kind of the path right now. And so they had experiences, you know, they had things they could talk about.
Well, I think in reading your column, there's certain directors that emerge as your favorites. I guess you're a huge fan of Raoul Walsh.
Oh, yeah. Walsh, a great example of a guy who's just never quite gotten the recognition he deserves, probably because he made so many movies over the years. It's easy to get lost in the weeds sometimes with these guys. Mm-hmm. But again, very consistent personal vision, very personal style. And he certainly made some second-rate films, but even in those films, you can feel his intelligence at work. You know, he's trying to do something there, even if he isn't succeeding.
Sometimes I look and I see that the majority of my favorite movies were directed by Michael Curtiz, but he's not a guy who particularly has a style or a... Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you disagree.
Well, I think he has a style. It's hard to say if he has a subject, I think, with Curtiz. He's a director who comes out of that Weimar Germany tradition of camera movement and very detailed lighting. He likes creating these complex spaces with a wonderful sense of depth and then moving his camera through them. The films are almost abstract in a way. There's always a scene in the Curtiz film set in a nightclub or a cafe, and I think the reason he likes to do that is so he can move his camera around through all those tables, you know, through all the different the extras, the architecture. He just loves that sense of unfolding space.
And of course, Casablanca would be a great example of that, right?
It's a great example of that. Yeah, yeah. Whether he's like a Hawks or a Hitchcock or a Ford who has his own ideas about the world and is using his films to express them, maybe not. You know, at least I haven't been able to find that myself in Curtiz.
He does seem to bring some great performances out of his actors.
Yeah, he was, considering he barely spoke English, he was able to get some astonishingly good readings from people.
There's a picture on the cover of your book that makes me think about that. This book by Dave Kerr called When Movies Matter. It's got a great picture that looks like it's taken from the set of Vertigo. And you've got Kim Novak listening intently to something that Hitchcock is saying to her.
And Stewart looking a little irritated that no one's paying attention to him.
It's a great picture. But you often hear that that Hitchcock didn't speak to his actors much, although he's definitely talking to Kim Novak here.
Again, I think that's an image that he liked to cultivate. You know, the actors are cattle, which started out as a joke. He preferred, I think, to work with actors who knew what they were doing, like Grant or Stewart. He was not someone who expected to build a character from the ground up. He would cast an actor because they brought a particular personality that he wanted. You know, Grant for the lighter films, Stewart for the heavier films, so on and so forth. You know, very sensitive to the meaning that was kind of already embedded in the actor. It's something that's changed these days because actors do not have that kind of long career. They don't like to be what they call typecast, although I kind of think that's a positive thing. Cary Grant kind of played the same character for 30 years and played it beautifully and played it with great depth and feeling and emotion. He did not often step out of a relatively narrow range of personalities, but what he did was just stunningly brilliant. And I just, you know, watching Daniel Day-Lewis, who was a great technician, you know, unquestionably, I feel nothing for him. I don't know who this guy is. I'm not getting any emotional connection. I don't have a history with him, you know, the way that you do with
Bing Crosby or Jimmy Stewart or some of those people that were in a lot of movies, you know. I mean, how would you do an imitation of Brad Pitt or Tom Hanks the way you would of Jimmy Stewart or Humphrey Bogart? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think Tom Hanks you could probably do. I mean, Hanks is one of the guys who's maintained that idea. Hanks is always, to some degree, Tom Hanks, or, you know, the Tom Hanks persona that he's created. Not so much true of Day-Lewis, not so much true of Meryl Streep, De Niro, kind of that 70s generation of the really highly skilled, trained theatrical actor that changed our idea of what movie stars were. De Niro plays a great actor, I guess, rather than James Cagney, who plays James Cagney.
Mm-hmm. But I think, I don't know, I love De Niro. He's a wonderful actor. But that scene in Raoul Walsh's White Heat when Cagney learns of his mother's death is a pretty amazing scene.
Well, it's incredible, yeah. And Cagney was a great actor with a tremendous amount of emotional power that he could just let loose. Staggering stuff, just a gigantic personality. I can't think of anything like that with De Niro. Again, these guys are kind of, already playing at a pitch that doesn't allow the contrast, doesn't allow the building up to the big, the release of a scene like the prison, the dining hall scene you're talking about.
Yeah, that's so amazing scene, isn't it? Well, in your recent article about ATAX, you referenced Jerry Lewis for a minute, and you talked about the Jerry Lewis film that we'll probably never see, The Day the Clown Cried, or whatever it's called.
Right. Yeah.
What do you think of Jerry Lewis as a filmmaker?
Oh, I think he's a great filmmaker. If I had to say, who is the greatest living American filmmaker, I would say Jerry Lewis. Not that he's been active for many years, but
he's living.
His understanding of form is really remarkably sophisticated. Had a huge influence on people like Jean-Luc Godard. His use of color, again, this very creative use of space. Quite an original stylist. And he's got, something profound and profoundly uncomfortable to say about America. He's got his finger on something about us that is kind of embarrassing and then kind of great.
When you're watching a film, Dave Kerr, and do you have to think to yourself, "Oh, I'm going to be writing about this, so I have to watch for, I have to see how Vincente Minnelli is going to use red or something, so that I'll have something to hang my paper on," or do you just see these things?
I think the trick is kind of shifting back and forth in that perspective. Certainly trying to experience the film emotionally at the same time you're looking for the things that are producing that emotion. One of the drawbacks of being a film critic is that you very seldom have a chance to see a film more than once before you write about it. So as a book critic can skip back a few pages and examine the passage that builds up to something else. Film critic, you've just got a one shot at it, particularly when you're working for a daily paper. You've got to run back to the office and type it up instantly. So you have to develop that dual perspective, at once intellectual and emotional. Not easy to do, and I don't know, sometimes I... probably fairly often, err on one side or the other. It's hard to find that right balance.
Well, the result has been some marvelous journalism, and your book, it's called When Movies Mattered, Reviews from a Transformative Decade. Dave Kerr is the author and has been my guest. We've just been chatting away, and all of a sudden our time is gone. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, real pleasure, Gary.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next week. You can find us in the meantime at our website, fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can find us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Dave Kerr, his book, When Movies Mattered, Reviews from a Transformative Decade. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night.